Perhaps you've had that experience of coming home after you've been out somewhere and someone in the house is watching a film. And so you sit down and watch the last 15 or 20 minutes of the film with them, and you find it a quite absorbing film. And of course it leads you in a bit of a quandary, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, because the film seemed good, you kind of want to watch the rest of it and get the whole experience, but then on the other hand, you know now how it ends, and so there's not that much point in watching the rest of it. But I mention that at the outset this morning because we're going to do something slightly similar now. In Acts chapter 10, verses 34 to 43, the Apostle Peter is making a speech. It's a bit of an odd setting. He's not in a church, he's not in a synagogue, he's not on the streets. He's been invited into the house of a complete stranger, a man called Cornelius. And there he's making this speech, and so the audience is simply the friends and family of this man, Cornelius. And in this speech then, in Acts 10, 34 to 43, Peter simply gives an overview of the life of Jesus. And what we're going to do now is we're going to kind of walk into Cornelius's house, as it were, as Peter is almost at the end of this speech. We're going to crash in on the last little bit of it. To make it easier, I can tell you that so far Peter has covered three stages of Jesus' life. He's left out Jesus' birth and childhood, but he's mentioned, number one, Jesus' anointing with the Holy Spirit in the River Jordan on the day of his baptism. He's mentioned, number two, Jesus' itinerant ministry, going around healing people and doing good. And he's mentioned, number three, Jesus' death by crucifixion. That's where Peter has got to. And now let's hear the last bit of his speech. So this is verses 40 to 43 of Acts 10. But God raised Jesus on the third day and caused him to appear, not to all the people, but to us who have been chosen by God as witnesses, who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. And he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead. To him all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. That's the last bit of this speech that Peter makes. And so I want us to notice quickly in this last bit of the speech three things. First of all, a stunning claim. A stunning claim. Because Peter claims then here, in those words I've just read, Peter claims that 3 days after Jesus' death by crucifixion, he appeared. That's what he says in verse 40. But I guess if that were the full extent of the claim, perhaps it wouldn't be anything to get too excited about. Because actually the really crucial bit of the claim comes later. It comes in the next verse, verse 42. Verse 41. Where he says that we ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. We ate and drank with Jesus after he rose from the dead. There's a classic Fawlty Towers episode that some of you may be aware of. It's Basil and Sybil Fawlty's wedding anniversary. And Basil has arranged a surprise party for the occasion. But when the day comes, Sybil is absolutely convinced that Basil has forgotten the anniversary completely, and so she storms out in a huff. And it's just after she's left that these guests start turning up for the surprise party. So it leaves Basil in a bit of an awkward situation. He can't really tell these guests, oh, my wife's just stormed off in a huff. So instead he tells them that she's ill and she's upstairs in bed. And that satisfies the guests for a little while, but then they become restless and they indicate to Basil that before they go, they want to at least briefly pop in and see Sybil. And so, of course, that throws Basil into a panic, and so he persuades Polly, the waitress, to pretend she's Sybil and to get into bed and pretend she's very ill. And once she's done that, Basil then kind of cautiously allows the guests into the bedroom, making sure it's very dark in there, making sure they don't get too close to the bed, and desperately hoping they won't see through the deception. Of course, as has to happen, she turns up. The real Sybil turns up while this is going on, and that throws up all kinds of other elements to the confusion. But my point is this, that when Peter here claims that he and others, these witnesses that he mentions, when he claims that he and others saw Jesus alive again after the crucifixion, he doesn't mean that they saw Jesus in a similar way to how those party guests saw Sybil in that bedroom. He's not talking about some very unnatural, highly controlled appearance of Jesus to them, where the lights were turned down and they weren't allowed to get too close to him, and there was no real meaningful interaction between him and them, and it was all a bit strange and a bit contrived and a bit suspicious. That's not what Peter's talking about. He's talking about Jesus and them hanging out together. Their experience of this alive again Jesus wasn't a matter of flimsy, insubstantial, debatable sightings. No, he and they spent time together, doing together all the normal things that close companions do, eating and drinking together in the same natural way that they had eaten and drunk together over those 3 years prior to Jesus' death. That's what Peter is claiming here. It really is a stunning claim. And let me just say this then, to anyone here this morning who is perhaps a little sceptical about the whole thing, a bit sceptical about Jesus rising from the dead. Yes, you've come along to an Easter Sunday service, but really, when all's said and done, you're a bit sceptical about Jesus' resurrection. Let me say this, that you can't be innocently mistaken when you're making the kind of claim that Peter is making here. I mean, if you're claiming that you fleetingly saw someone from a distance amidst the evening shadows, then yes, you can be innocently mistaken. But if you're claiming that you ate and drank with someone, you can't be innocently mistaken about that. Which means that really we're faced with only two options. Either Peter and these other witnesses were uttering deliberate, blatant, barefaced lies about Jesus rising from the dead, or they were telling the truth. It really is as simple as that. There's no middle way. Either the writers of the New Testament were unscrupulous liars, and we should reject this book as an evil, nasty, deceitful publication, or they were honest men, and we should face up to the fact this morning that Jesus actually did rise from the dead. You can't fudge that stark choice by saying, oh, well, these guys, they were well-meaning but naive. They thought they'd seen him, but they hadn't really seen him. No, the claim they are making is too extensive, it's too concrete, it's too full-blown for that. We ate and drank with him. That's the claim that these men are making. So that's the first thing this morning, a stunning claim. But then, notice secondly, a strategic choice. A strategic choice, because Peter is quite upfront here, isn't he? That these appearances then of the alive again Jesus, they had a certain exclusiveness about them. They weren't indiscriminate. He says that these appearances, they were not to all the people, verse 41, but to us who have been chosen by God as witnesses. He's referring there clearly to the apostles. They are the ones whom God had chosen to be these witnesses of the alive again Jesus. Now, in actual fact, we know from other New Testament passages that a much wider circle of people than just the apostles experienced encounters with the alive again Jesus. So you think, for instance, of Mary Magdalene. And on that occasion, just hours after Jesus had come out of the tomb, she's there in that garden and she thinks she's talking with a gardener, but then she suddenly realizes it's no gardener, it is Jesus. So she has an encounter with him. Well, then there's those two individuals and they're making their way from Jerusalem to a village called Emmaus. And as they're doing so, someone else comes and walks with them for some of the journey. And it's only after a while that they realize this is Jesus alive again. In fact, Paul, he refers to one appearance of the alive again Jesus to a group of 500 people altogether. So these resurrection appearances, they weren't as exclusive as we might think just from reading this verse. Jesus' resurrection appearances, they weren't like Bob Dylan's Nobel Prize winning appearance that happened a couple of weeks ago. Just him and 12 members of the Nobel Academy in a secret venue in Stockholm. No reporters, no photographers, no family and friends or fellow artists. Just this private little group. Jesus' resurrection appearances were far more inclusive than that. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is basically saying to the Christians in Corinth, he's saying, if you're unsure about Jesus' resurrection, then go and find someone who saw him. Because there are plenty of eyewitnesses floating around out there, he's saying. It's not that difficult to find someone who met Jesus after he had come back to life. So we mustn't exaggerate the situation, I'm saying. But nonetheless, Peter's words here do point to a certain exclusiveness about these appearances. And we need to ask the question, why is that? Why didn't Jesus, having come back from death, show himself to more people? It's an interesting question, isn't it? Well, the answer, I think, is that Jesus' resurrection had far-reaching implications which needed to be properly understood and carefully explained. Jesus' resurrection had far-reaching implications which needed to be properly understood and carefully explained. Some of you may remember how in 2003 the American endurance artist, as I think these people are called, David Blaine, he spent 44 days in a glass box, suspended in a glass box from a crane of some description. Now, where did he do that? Did he do it in some African desert or in an Amazonian rainforest or in a Norwegian mountain range or something? No, he did it in London. And he did it right beside the Tower Bridge. Why did he choose that location? Well, because this was a stunt, wasn't it? It was an attention-grabbing piece of theatre, essentially, intended to impress people and make people go, wow, what a feat to stay in a box for 44 days, suspended in midair. It had no deeper meaning than that. And because that's what it was a stunt, a piece of theatre, David Blaine naturally wanted as many people as possible to see it. Actually, it backfired on him a bit because the Londoners weren't quite so impressed as he hoped they would be, and people pelted the box with eggs and subjected him to all kinds of other indignities. But you get the point, that if you're putting on an impressive stunt, then almost by definition you're interested in numbers. You're interested in gaining as big an audience as possible. But you see, when Jesus rose from the dead, it wasn't a stunt like that. His purpose wasn't to provoke an excited reaction amongst the crowds. He wasn't looking for gasps and wows and video clips of his nail prints to go viral online. If so, he would have shown himself to as many people as possible. He would have booked a tour bus and travelled all around Palestine and beyond and filled stadiums and said, look at me, everyone. I've come back from death. Line up here to have a selfie with me, the resurrection man. But no. Because his resurrection wasn't that kind of thing. Yes, of course, it was impressive. Far more impressive, in fact, than being suspended in a glass box for 44 days. Or indeed anything else that David Blaine or any of these guys have ever pulled off in their careers. It had the wow factor, all right, but beyond the wow factor, Jesus' resurrection had a profound significance. It meant something momentous. It had far-reaching implications. And those implications would need to be communicated to the world by these apostles. And so spending time with them following the resurrection, it was a strategic choice by Jesus. Instead of wasting time meeting lots of people, so that by the end of his resurrection tour, there were thousands of impressed people, but no one really getting it. Instead of doing that, he concentrated mainly on these few men and on explaining everything to them, so that through their ministry there would eventually be multitudes of people not merely impressed superficially by Jesus' resurrection, but understanding it and their lives transformed by it. All of which raises the question for us this morning, then, well, what are these far-reaching implications of Jesus' resurrection that I keep mentioning? If this event, it wasn't just a stunt, if it had some profound significance, what is that profound significance? What does Jesus' resurrection mean? Well, that's where we must come on to our third heading this morning. A strange combination. A stunning claim, a strategic choice. Thirdly, a strange combination. Because according to Peter then, this is what Jesus' resurrection means. It means that he has two particular roles. You sometimes come across people, don't you, who seem to have a strange combination of jobs. So there's a gentleman that we've had to do some work from time to time in the church building here, and he's an electrician, and it's in that capacity that we've had him do work here in the church building. But this man, he's also a practicing Church of England vicar. Whether it means that his sermons are very electrifying, I don't know, but those are the two roles that he combines. I was talking recently to a man who's a pilot. He's a pilot with a top international airline, but then he's also a farmer. Now, I would have thought that dealing with a stubborn sheep on a muddy hillside and operating the sophisticated controls of a Boeing 737 were quite different skills, and they wouldn't necessarily go together, but this guy seems to manage both. And so you get these strange combinations. And the two roles then that Jesus has by virtue of his resurrection, they seem a bit of a strange combination. So first of all, in verse 42, Peter says that he is the one appointed by God to be judge. Jesus is the one appointed by God to be judge. Now, it's a basic concept that you find everywhere in the Bible, that this world is going to end on a note of complete justice. There's going to be a day when everything that every human being has ever done will be properly scrutinized and evaluated. But what a responsibility that is for someone to carry that out. A few years ago, I sat on an appeals panel listening to parents whose children had missed out on a place at a particular school. And our job as a panel then was to assess whether these appeals had any valid grounds, whether they should be granted or not. And that was tricky enough. But assessing everything that every human being has ever done, I mean, that's on a different scale altogether. Who is qualified for such a role? Last week we had the appointment, didn't we, of a Supreme Court Justice in the United States. And it was a big deal. I mean, over months, gallons of ink has been spilt on this appointment. And who should fulfill that honourable, crucial, dignified role? But this is a bigger deal that we're talking about. The judge of all men and women and boys and girls. Who should fulfill that honourable role? Who stands out sufficiently from everyone else? Well, how about a person who has been dead and has come back to life again? He does, doesn't he? And so that's one role then that Jesus has by virtue of his resurrection. His resurrection qualifies him to be the judge of the whole human race. That's one role. But then in verse 43, Peter says something else. He says that everyone who believes in him, that's in Jesus, receives forgiveness of sins. You see, Jesus' death by crucifixion on the Friday, it wasn't just any old death. It wasn't even just a nasty, cruel death, but it was a sacrificial death to atone for people's sins. Now, had he remained dead after it, then it would have gone down as a colossal failure. No one would have been atoned for by that. But of course, he didn't remain dead. He rose. His resurrection confirmed the effectiveness of his sacrifice. It confirmed that he had indeed secured real atonement on the cross. And so this is the second role, Peter says, that Jesus has by virtue of his resurrection. It means he can provide forgiveness of sins. So these are the implications, Peter is saying, of Jesus' resurrection. What does it mean? It means that Jesus has these two roles. He's judge and he's the source of forgiveness. And as I say, that seems a strange combination, doesn't it? They seem like kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. We wouldn't think of justice and forgiveness as coming through the same person. But both, Peter is saying, are within Jesus' remit. And this morning then, I want you all to go away, yes, at the most basic level, believing Peter's claim here that Jesus really did rise from the dead. That's crucial. That you see we're in the realm here of historical fact, not legend, not myth, not fiction, not allegory, but historical fact. So I want you to go away, yes, believing that at the most basic level. But I don't want you to go away believing that and just saying, wow, what a feat. Coming back from death, it's like being suspended in a glass box for 44 days, only better. No. I want you to go away reflecting on these two roles that Jesus has because he rose from the dead. He's judge. Because he rose, he's judge. Now that's solemn, and that should sober us all deeply this morning. One day Jesus Christ is going to sift through every deed you've ever done, every word you've ever spoken, every thought you've ever entertained, your behavior in every relationship, the way you've handled money, your reaction when anyone has rubbed you up the wrong way, your motives, your ambitions. Every skeleton in the cupboard will be uncovered. Every murky secret will be dredged up. Which of us can face such a prospect unconcerned? Which of us can expect anything other than utter condemnation and severe punishment once Jesus has analysed everything in our lives? This is terrifying, and it should make us tremble this morning. But then he's not only judge. He has this other role. He's the source of forgiveness. And that should thrill our souls this morning. That you can believe in Jesus. Notice that's the language Peter uses. Everyone who believes in him. You can believe in Jesus now. That is, you can trust in him. You can rely on him. You can appeal to him now for forgiveness through his sacrifice. And if you do, you will get it. So that then, when on that day he sifts through all the data of your lives, Every fault he finds, he will say, it's forgiven. And this one's forgiven. And that one's forgiven. And that one's forgiven. My blood paid for this one. My blood paid for that one. My blood paid for this one. All of them. Each and every one. Each sin. Each misdeed. Each fault. Each failure. Every one forgiven through my blood. That possibility should make our hearts dance this morning. Are you believing in him? Are you trusting in him? Are you relying on him? Have you appealed to him for forgiveness through his sacrifice? If not, will you do so this morning? Notice the disparity between the scope of these two roles of Jesus. So he's judge in a universal sense, isn't he? Judge of the living and the dead. That's just another way of saying everyone. Absolutely everyone. We all will experience him in that capacity, whether we like it or not, whatever we say and do, it's just a fact. We will experience him as judge. But he's not the source of forgiveness in a universal sense. It's only those who believe in him, Peter says, who will experience him in that capacity. And so my plea to you this morning is, make sure you don't have a one-sided experience of Jesus Christ. Don't carry on as you are perhaps this morning, ignoring Jesus, just having a bit to do with him on Easter Sunday and at Christmas and so on. Don't just carry on in that way and then only experience him as your judge, because that will be disastrous. Experience him first as the source of forgiveness. Experience him now as that. Experience him this morning as that. And then experiencing him as your judge will have nothing to be feared. It won't be a problem. Believe in him this morning and know forgiveness. Everything you've ever done that remotely offends God, cancelled, wiped out. As Rhys was illustrating earlier on. All gone, all done away with. Come to him this morning as your forgiver, and you won't need to fear him in his capacity as your judge. Amen.